So pervasive is its influence that Americans today can scarcely imagine a world without the Federal Reserve. To begin with, the Fed, America's central bank, issues the Federal Reserve notes that we call money. It sets the short-term interest rate that affects the market for mortgages, car loans, corporate debt, and even the level of the stock market. It manages, sometimes adroitly and sometimes wantingly, the supply of credit, whose ebb and flow alternately buoys and batters business. It supervises, or is supposed to supervise, the nation's banks. And, as Americans were vividly reminded during the meltdown of 2008, the Federal Reserve acts as the lender of last resort, providing loans to banks when credit shuts down. Barely a century ago, the Fed did not exist. Every other industrialized nation had such a central bank to oversee its banking system and to assure stability, yet America's financial system, if system one can call it, was antiquated, disorganized, and deficient. The United States boasted the world's largest economy. Its vast territory was ribboned with railroad tracks and telephone wires. Its cities were bursting with factories churning out iron and steel. Yet, almost as if history had missed a turn, its banks were disconnected and isolated, left to prosper or flounder or fail according to the reserves of each individual institution. As Paul Warburg, one of the heroes of this story, was to observe with his trademark acuity, America's banks resembled less an army commanded by a central staff than they did an inchoate legion of disjointed and disunited infantry. It was hardly surprising that throughout the latter half of the 19th century and into the early 20th, the United States, alone among the industrial powers, suffered a continual spate of financial panics, bank runs, money shortages, and indeed, full-blown depressions. This book tells the story of how, culminating in the days before Christmas 1913, the Federal Reserve came to be. It was not a gentle or an easy birth, nor was it swift. To Americans of the early 20th century, especially farmers, the prospect of a central bank threatened the comfortable Jeffersonian principle of small government. To a people for whom local autonomy was sacrosanct, the notion of a powerful bank joined to an even more powerful federal government was deeply unnerving. Opposition to central authority had animated the Minutemen at Lexington and Concord, and the battle to establish the Fed resembled a second American Revolution. A financial revolution. America had, of course, experimented with central banking early in its history. After the War of Independence, a military success but a financial disaster, the government was saddled with debt. When in due course the Constitution was ratified, providing a greater degree of political unity, Alexander Hamilton proposed a financial equivalent, a Bank of the United States, modeled after the Bank of England. Thomas Jefferson was mightily opposed, as were his many followers. Nonetheless, President Washington was persuaded, as was a majority of Congress, and in 1791, the bank, headquartered in Philadelphia, opened for business. To modernize, the bank was a strange beast, 20% owned by the government and 80% by private investors. It was authorized to hold the government's deposits, but not, specifically, to be the nation's monetary steward or to perform other functions of a central bank. Nonetheless, the bank began to play this role. In particular, it strengthened the previously shoddy credit of the federal government. The 20 years of its initial charter were generally prosperous, and the number of private banks which received charters from the states swelled from 5 to more than 100. But the bank was doomed by the rise of the Anti-Federalists, both in the White House, in the person of James Madison, and in Congress. Rechartering failed by one vote in each chamber. Thus, in 1811, America was returned to a condition of monetary innocence, or laissez-faire, money again being the business of individual banks in the states, each of which issued notes according to its respective powers. Inflation followed, and when the government's credit became overtaxed by the War of 1812, banks suspended operations, causing Madison to rethink matters. In 1816, Congress, now with Madison's endorsement, chartered the Second Bank of the United States. The Second Bank, though endowed with more capital, was in most respects a replica of the first. It succeeded at restraining the state banks from issuing too many notes, thus keeping a lid on inflation. It worked to mute excesses in the business cycle, and the bank's notes were widely accepted as a common currency, no small thing for a nation pushing across an unsettled continent. But the second bank met a fate no better than the first. Although Congress approved its recharter, the margin was not sufficient to override the determined veto of Andrew Jackson. In 1836, the National Bank was, for the second time, allowed to expire. Once again, the country experienced an inflation, this time followed by a severe depression. In 1841, Congress chartered a third bank. President John Tyler, a Southerner preoccupied with states' rights, vetoed it. And there, for some seven decades, matters rested.